Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's episode, we've got a lightning round where we'll talk about a number of stories in a shorter amount of time. We'll also talk about national retail properties as they revealed earnings on Wednesday of this week. We lead our show with a pair of supermarket-related stories as well. Now, quick apologies for not recording last week. I was under the weather. I actually had pneumonia. So if we had recorded last week, you just would have heard a bunch of coughing, which is not altogether unlike what it probably sounds like anyway when I'm well. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast, and you can like us or rate us anywhere you do find us. As we talk about, we'll talk about a pair of grocery stories in one. The employee strike ends at Stop and Shop. We'll talk about that and the impacts to the company, and also Wegmans announcing bold plans to enter an already crowded marketplace in the mid-Atlantic. But we begin with Stop and Shop. And Leighton, this is a strike that had been going on for 8 days before a resolution was reached back on late Sunday of April 21st.
Striking workers ended up heading back to work on April 22nd, so just a day after the resolution had come to fruition. For Stop and Shop's operating company, the Netherlands-based Ahold Delhaize, it became a balance between standing their ground on concessions to employees and losing money due to the strike's impact on their store base and bottom line. And earlier this week, as detailed by Supermarket News, one of our most favorite online outlets, Ahold Delhaize gave financial updates on how the strike might impact this year's financials overall. The strike, which had been well publicized by many, especially on the East Coast out there, involved over 31,000 workers from Stop and Shop locations in Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. Just under 250 stores were affected by the strike, which started on April 11th. The employees were members of the United Food and Commercial Workers Union and were generally not pleased with the lack of progress on the new collectively bargained contract. And this is interesting because this is something that they had agreed to, you know, really trying to negotiate prematurely, but just could not hash out the details. The workers had basically been working without a contract, and their previous contract with Stop and Shop expired on February 23rd, and no resolution had been reached through those prior negotiations, and that new contract didn't come about. Even still, the current agreement is tentative. So this is important to note that there could be a strike down the road, but it's tentative for now and pending approval by five local unions involved in the bargaining process. So although the terms were not released of the contract, Ahold Delhaize's CEO Franz Mueller said that the deal apparently includes an offer of pay increases and for eligible associates' health insurance and access to pension benefits. Pensions have been a hot-button topic in legacy retail circles, with the most notable pension issues coming from Sears Holdings in their lead-up to their bankruptcy. And you see a lot of retailers, even Kroger, talking about those impacts from legacy pension plans. Not only Kroger, but you see JCPenney having issues paying those obligations off. And you see it almost more as a long-term burden than a long-term opportunity for some previous employees that are reaping the benefits of those older pension plans. But now, as far as impacts to Stop and Shop are concerned, this gave loyal customers a window to potentially shop at other stores. This is negative for the company, and these windows, during which customers may change loyalty, are crucial for a grocer. And as we discussed on a previous podcast, data from Cardlytics suggests that January or back-to-school openings are typical windows where loyalty is established or reestablished. In this case, Skyhook, a Boston-based location data company, estimated that visits to Stop and Shop declined 75% in the, and I quote, loyalty customer category, while visits at local competitors ended up spiking. The data range studied was between April 12th and April 14th. The big question is, how many of those customers will return back to Stop and Shop post-strike? Or were the competitors doing just enough to be able to win them over for the long term?
And to that point, Ahold Delhaize gave refreshed financial guidance last week. They actually revealed the impact from the strike could hit operating profit by 90 to 110 million. And again, the question remains as to whether the delay in signing a new deal was worth it, given the potentially long-term financial impact on the company if some of those customers that Leighton was mentioning don't end up coming back. In other words, did they get enough in concessions from the employees to warrant the delay? In any case, a hold delays also lowered guidance on earnings per share, but did not change overall first quarter expectations for revenue. In other words, saying that, hey, the strike probably going to hurt their bottom line, not so much the top line. And apparently the main financial issues from the strike, at least in the short term, stem from increased shrink on seasonal inventory, as well as issues with perishables. So if you're not staffing the stores, you're having issues with turnover, customers aren't coming in, suddenly the lettuces are going bad, the eggs are going bad, that type of thing. So there's some issues there. Also, supply chain costs increasing as a result of the strike. Now, they did note that reduced sales could be seen from the Stop and Shop division, but didn't revise their global sales numbers downwards, suggesting that the company's other holdings might wallpaper over any top-line hit that they might get from the Stop and Shop division. So now let's move over to Wegmans. Wegmans, a retailer very familiar to those in upstate New York and areas surrounding. As though Virginia and the Carolinas weren't crowded enough with grocers, Rochester-based Wegmans has announced plans to expand into those markets, to expand southward once again, per a Supermarket News article. Now, this area of the country saw the initial North American expansion efforts from Lidl, but Harris Teeter and Walmart also have significant holdings in the area. Of course, Harris Teeter, one of those Kroger affiliates, and as if that weren't enough, Publix has also begun a northward expansion in earnest into the area. So they have several locations in the exact markets, in fact, that Wegmans will be testing out. And it's interesting because Publix and Wegmans often rank 1-2 in some order in grocery consumer sentiment surveys, both of whom have a large cult following. Both are now opening large square foot locations in that same mid-Atlantic area. Now, the initial opening in the region for Wegmans was scheduled for April 28th. This is the furthest south Wegmans has ventured, at least for now. The store slated to be around 113,000 square feet when all is said and done, with most of the trappings of Wegmans' newly opened stores. So these include a lot of in-store prep areas, a robust produce section, a large seafood area. One of the things that Wegmans is most known for is their seafood, and a casual restaurant called the Burger Bar within the store, among other things. However, the store chain also announced earlier in April their intention to open a 104,000 square foot store in North Carolina. This location would be in the ever-growing Raleigh area in the Midtown East Shopping Center. That's expected to open actually coming up in September of this year. So that location that is opening for Wegmans in Virginia, and we should mention that's going to be in Virginia, that'll be the furthest south, at least until the September opening of that location in the Research Triangle. And that area is one of the fastest growing metro areas in the United States, and that's one of the reasons why it's attracted so much attention from all of these other companies. Publix already has 6 Raleigh area locations. They've been fighting tooth and nail to open up stores there, try to capture some market share early on, but they aren't the only one. Lowe's Foods, Food Lion also there, Harris Teeter as we mentioned, Lidl as we mentioned, the Fresh Market has stores there, and that's before we get to Sprouts and Whole Foods, Walmart also there, several local competitors, IGAs and the like, also have a presence there. So it makes one wonder if this is going to be a positive risk for Wegmans, considering the massive existing presence that's already there. Wegmans kind of hoping their open-air layout will win customers over, but again, they're about 2 years behind Publix in terms of the fight of those grocers with those cult followings in their effort to capture whatever market share might be available for capture, because again, you're fighting against some established brands and a lot of newer brands like Lidl, like we mentioned, that already have a solid amount of market share. And of course, Harris Teeter, a local favorite, Food Lion, a local favorite for many in that particular market. In addition to that first North Carolina location, the grocer has already laid out plans for 4 more North Carolina locations in the immediate future. These include locations in Cary and West Cary, as well as Chapel Hill, and another location that was just announced, actually, for the Wake Forest area. Other Mid-Atlantic locations in the works for Wegmans include one in Delaware, two in Maryland, a Washington, D.C. location, and four in Virginia. And again, fighting against a lot of those established retailers that we've talked about, the likes of Harris Teeter, but also the likes of Publix, who is moving further north. So it's going to be an interesting circumstance in which Wegmans really putting a lot of eggs in this particular basket in this region of the country.
All of this after their much publicized entry into the New York City metro area. Although the chain is based in upstate New York, they've been loath to enter New York City for some time now. This is likely a consequence of a few different things here. First, of course, being that there's a massive cost of real estate anywhere in New York City. And it's interesting, if you just go on LoopNet and search a basic search for a retail property in New York City, we're talking the heart of where the real estate for either retail or family housing, multifamily, is extremely expensive. You would just be astounded at some of the compressed cap rates there in that particular area. The cost of doing business, therefore, is extremely expensive. And that's why a lot of the times you see a push for retailers to open up stores really more is just a publicity stunt. This isn't anything that's going to be sustainable for the long term, and you're not going to be really taking any profits per store. And you think of an already compressed grocery environment where margins are razor thin. You're talking about net margins between maybe 2%, 3%, and 4% with the biggest grocers here in the United States. You really have to wonder, does any foray in the New York City area make any sense here in this particular story? Their first New York City location, by the way, is slated to open this fall, over 4 years after it was first announced. So probably looking and negotiating and trying to get the actual best deal they can for this particular scenario. And the second location, by the way, is scheduled to open in 2020. So sort of taking it slow here with that penetration. Now, we speak of this expansion effort on a market-by-market basis, and you look overall at the big picture, this is truly a rapid expansion for a store chain that only currently has 98 stores in its system. So Virginia store will be number 99. The North Carolina store will be location number 100. So it is quite a risk for Wegmans to basically be adding to its store base by around 15% over the next few years, all in areas outside its current distribution network. For contrast, Publix, a company that Trent just got done talking about, had well over 1,000 stores before making their reach into the Mid-Atlantic region. Currently, Publix has over 1,200 locations in the United States, so they had a larger base to pull from, and it means less to them financially if their locations fail. Likewise, Lidl ended up not really having any locations before they made their foray, their recent expansion into the United States. But they're backed by a powerful European base, had a lot of capital, and could really absorb any U.S. losses. And by the way, they reportedly did. If some or all of these stores don't make it off the ground, this could be a heavy financial blow for the company. But at the same time, you could argue that it is worth taking a risk. After all, they have mostly saturated many of their native markets, and many of their native markets aren't growing in terms of population. That's something that a lot of big grocery retailers like to look at, those all-important local demographics. Unlike the Mid-Atlantic, which has robust metropolitan areas in Washington, D.C. and Raleigh, there isn't really too much room for them to expand immediately westward either. So you have to take out a wider lens if you're looking at other states. When you look at market growth, it's just not there. Too far west from Rochester, and you begin to run into Meijer and Kroger wheelhouses. If they can open enough southern locations to make distribution worthwhile, the gamble may well pay off, but it's difficult to see exactly how Wegmans can differentiate from all the other entrants, especially in Raleigh. In particular, that market's a little tough because most of them do have the add-ons that Wegman boasts in their larger locations.
Our next story on the Retail Focus podcast has to do with one of Layton's favorite subjects in retail real estate. National Retail Properties revealed earnings on Wednesday. So we're going to be talking about a retail-centric REIT here, and their occupancy rates continue to suggest a robust retail environment. Now, this is a story where, yeah, we'll talk about the numbers a little bit, but we're more interested as to the methods National Retail Properties go about their business use to go about their business, and mainly how they're getting things done in a retail environment. I'm sure everyone reads those stories. It talks about, you know, people abandoning brick and mortar and occupancy rates decreasing for retail brick and mortar. And I think we see here, at least through National Retail Properties, what they do is kind of unique, and it gives us a little bit of a view into how they operate. Now, one unique thing about NRP is that they invest in a lot of single-tenant properties. So things like convenience stores, auto parts stores, or even freestanding dollar stores, although they don't hold a ton of the dollar stores in their portfolio, but it gives you an idea as to what we're working with here in terms of retail real estate. So we're not talking about malls and shopping centers here, but rather we're talking about the single-tenant buildings. And so this is an excellent view of a retail landscape that a lot of people don't talk about very often. Their earnings call also provides a little bit of comfort in a landscape where we're constantly barraged with messages about retail apocalypses and mall failures, that type of thing. But it also provides insight on that dynamic that, honestly, we don't get a chance to talk about much, and certainly mainstream business media doesn't focus on much, if at all, in some of those freestanding single-tenant buildings. And what we're seeing here is a lot of those tenants that are in those single-tenant buildings are pretty happy, actually, with where they're at currently, which kind of dovetails with the earnings calls that we've been seeing in retail, not so much with the overarching news narrative. Now, National Retail Properties, to back up a little bit, they hold an eye-opening 2,984 properties, likely to go above 3,000 this year, actually, across 48 states. The gross leasable area of 30.7 million square feet. Their top states include Texas, Florida, and Ohio, but their holdings are fairly evenly spread across the U.S., which makes them an unusual REIT because a lot of REITs have areas where they feel at home more than others. For example, some REITs might capitalize on the Pacific Coast more, some might capitalize on the northeastern United States, some on the Midwest, and so forth. Now, the top retailers that NRP deals with by square feet include Camping World, but also 7-Eleven. You have Couche-Tard in there as well, so a major key in the convenience store space, and also BJ's Wholesale Club. So it's a varied group here. Camping World, one of the reasons they lead by square feet is just because their locations are so large physically, but again, a lot of convenience stores, a lot of single retailers, auto parts retailers thrown in there as well. Of their main non-retail holdings, LA Fitness and AMC Theater headline the group. By rent, 17.8% of their business is wrapped up actually in convenience stores. But as I talked about, they hold drug stores, furniture, and home improvement stores as well. Just 1.6% of their rents actually come from the general merchandise retailers that you sometimes think of when you think of a single-tenant building like a Dollar General or a Family Dollar or a Dollar Tree. Now, their adjusted earnings, or as the company calls them, adjusted funds from operations available to shareholders, came in right at analyst expectations of 68 cents per share. Depending on the analyst expectations you use, this even came in a penny above some consensus estimates. It's also in line with what was produced in the same quarter 1 year ago. However, other numbers surrounding the company lead one to believe that they've grown some over the last 12 months as they've focused a lot on acquisitions.
The acquisition-based focus of the company could be seen on a property-in, property-out level. We've talked about some retail REITs practicing timely divestments of their properties in the past and focusing on being very selective in terms of purchasing new properties. By selectivity, we really mean that their purchases of properties are beginning to thin out just a little bit. That isn't the case with National Retail Properties here. NRP, we'll say, sold 17 properties totaling $19.4 million. This is very reflective of their property's single-tenant nature, with their average price per property just above $1.1 million. Despite the relatively low average sale price there, the company still netted around $610,000 in gains on each single property sold. This is reflective of continued increase in retail real estate valuation in the United States, as well as their ability to sign longer-term leases and then therefore flip the properties. This is interesting. This is what a lot of developers do. If you think about new development, Somebody may construct a building and then end up selling it for a 40 to 50% margin. Rather than using those proceeds to buy up just a few new properties, NRP has aggressively reinvested into their portfolio, purchasing 33 new properties in the quarter. Rather amazingly, the 33 new properties they purchased in the first quarter carried with them an aggregate initial cash yield of 7%. Initial cash yield is commonly referred to as cap rate. And if you think of the cap rate as sort of a rate of return or a way to really analyze your investment upfront upon purchasing it, you can see how this is fairly substantial for a legitimized company such as NRP. A 7% cap rate essentially means that your net operating income divided by your initial purchase price should be around 7%. A lot of people can look at that as an annualized rate of return. However, a lot of these properties most likely carry a rent increase throughout the duration of the lease. Therefore, the average cap rate can be a little higher, maybe towards 8 or 9%. If you look at NRP's 2018 campaign, they averaged a 6.8% cap rate on new acquisitions. So they're actually doing a little bit better. A lot of people could point to the current interest rate environment and maybe how cap rates in some sectors of the real estate economy are increasing upward. Seldom does a quality property with a long-term lease come available for over a 6.5% cap, and that is definitely true, especially in those larger markets like we were mentioning earlier with New York City, with our previous story, and of course California, where it's not uncommon to see a 4% cap rate, dramatically lower than in some parts of the Midwest. NRP claims that their desire to purchase standalone properties versus the larger complexes results in a lack of competition to purchase the properties, which helps to keep cap rate compression in check somewhat. Their occupancy, while still high, did fall a bit from last year's first quarter. Occupancy rates for their portfolio were down to around 98.2%. from 99.2% this time last year. However, for comparison, the 98.2% occupancy rate far outpaces the national retail-centric REIT average of around 93% and far outpaces the supposed national occupancy rates for all retail properties. And you look at that basket, Trent, we're talking about numbers that are extremely good for any company right now in any sector of commercial real estate. Oftentimes you'll see office really come in maybe around the high 80% occupancy range. For retail, this is a sector that's been beaten up in the mainstream media. People talking about retail is dead. Well, retail is not dead. The dynamic, however, is changing. But as long as you're a company with enough resources behind it, the right management style and the right pragmatic ways of thinking, then you can keep that occupancy rate as high as this company. 98.2% is really nothing to scoff at here. On a recent earnings call at Shoe Carnival, the CEO stuck by his comments that the U.S. is over-retailed, but occupancy rates at the leading REITs suggest that there hasn't really been any significant pullback among the top retail landlords in the U.S. More amazing, perhaps, is their occupancy rates are this high with an 11.4-year weighted average remaining on the lease, which means a number of their tenants are in it for the long haul and really don't see a brick and mortar pullback either. And I think this means, Trent, a lot of positivity for this company. Fewer than 5% of their leases actually come due through the end of 2020.
That number in and of itself is astounding because what it points to is retailers' desires to re-sign leases early. And again, that's one of our reasons for talking about this story. Not so much interested in terms of the financial goings on there at this company, but rather the tendencies of retailers going forward. And what we're seeing right now is a lot of retailers re-signing leases early. And again, kind of flies in the face of what we're seeing a lot of talk about with this brick and mortar pullback, but that's not the case with some of these single tenant occupied spaces. The number of leases coming due through the end of 2020 was 4.7% for national retail properties earlier this year. So think about that. The number of leases coming due through the end of next year was 4.7% earlier this year. As of this earnings call, that number is down all the way to 3.4%. So it means that of those retailers that haven't yet inked long-term deals, they are beginning to do so now as 2019 moves forward. Only 1% of NRP's leases, that amounts to just 30 properties, have leases that expire by the end of 2019. So assuming the worst case scenario, none of those properties get leases signed, none of those properties get new tenants in, the occupancy rate for NRP would be no less than 97.2% come this time next year, which is still outstanding. It's still about 4 percentage points higher than the average retail-centric REIT. And in fact, if you wanted to look at it this way, NRP could not sign any lease renewals for the next 3 years and still not fall below the retail REIT average occupancy rate currently in the U.S. That is how strong this company is doing, but also reflective of those retailers signing those long-term deals, signing the 10, 15, 20-year deals that we're now starting to see. And we're seeing retailers have this confidence that maybe they didn't have 2 to 3 years ago to sign these longer-term deals. Now, NRP credits part of the reason for their success to what's called a self-selecting model, basically by maintaining a huge portfolio of triple net single tenant properties. It opens them up to working with retailers to determine locations that are ideal for these individual retailers. So their argument is that basically retail real estate in general has some unique advantages over other forms of commercial real estate, like you mentioned, offices and that type of thing. One main part being that retail properties are far less likely to want to disrupt consumer habits by moving a location. And because of that, retailers do a lot of due diligence before signing one of those long-term deals versus you think of a medical office or even just an office building in general might not do that research long-term because, again, you have to attract customers there if you're a retailer. So because of that, retailers will only sign long-term deals on properties they feel will be successful from a traffic standpoint. And again, that seems obvious, but this is sometimes lost when talking about larger multi-tenant properties. It can be difficult to evaluate a larger mall or a larger shopping center in the overall success of a property. If some retailers are successful, maybe if your anchor in a grocery-centric retail center is successful, but your outlying stores aren't, it can be very difficult to kind of parse that out. But we see here from National Retail Properties Portfolio is that there are a number of retailers that rent single-tenant properties that are very happy with their traffic and their footprint, so much so that they're willing to sign these deals for another 10 or 15 or 20 years in the future. And again, not something we often talk about, but certainly provides an interesting counterpoint that the idea that brick-and-mortar retailers and also restaurateurs, because NRP has a lot of those in their portfolio, are struggling to drive traffic to these locations in general. Because again, we're seeing these retailers being okay with these longer-term leases despite any supposed tailback of this brick-and-mortar traffic. So we're going to try something a little bit different here on the podcast. We're going to go through a lightning round. There were a lot of stories of the last couple of weeks that we wanted to discuss. And so kind of pared down the stories to their very basics so that we could talk about them and we had time to talk about them here on the podcast. And we lead off with a story regarding Kohl's. They agree to accept Amazon returns at all locations in the U.S. This is a story that was everywhere last week. Didn't get a chance to provide our take on it because of, again, my pneumonia, but Kohl's was seen as the first retailer to kind of partner up with Amazon here and take Amazon returns at certain locations, but other retailers like Rite Aid, who we mentioned in the last episode, are beginning to roll out some of these same return lockers that we're seeing here. Now, returns have been somewhat of a sore spot for e-commerce in general, with different companies going through different mechanisms to try and facilitate the return of product. Usually it consists of providing a prepaid shipping label to customers and having the customers drop off the packages with a carrier. Now, there are some issues with this system. For example, if a customer has recycled or disposed of the original box or the original shipping packaging, then they've got to come up with their own packaging for that packing slip. Or if a customer lives in a rural area, sometimes it's going to be a little bit of a trip for them to drop the packages off with a carrier. But it is worth mentioning that the return system for brick and mortar retailers isn't much less of a hassle because it still entails going to the store, which may be an inconvenience depending on the situation and location. But one thing oftentimes we don't think about a lot when it comes to e-commerce returns is, yeah, you can print out a shipping label and that type of thing. A lot of people just don't have printers. They don't have a way to print out those shipping labels. So the Amazon system through Kohl's at least takes a few of those friction points out in that they'll actually let and allow unpackaged returns free of charge at all Kohl's stores going forward.
Yeah, that's right. And this is interesting, Trent, because if you've ever seen a Kohl's that has sort of been transformed in this way, it's a little bit interesting. Things could be improved, but the overall, the repackaging, therefore, is sort of a friction point that has been removed as of late, essentially trading a Kohl's trip for having to repackage the product. And this is a continuation of the program initially rolled out, something that we covered here on the podcast in 2017. This was a pilot program initially, and you saw an immediate spike in the stock price of Kohl's at that time, ticker KSS. And as a pilot program to around 100 stores in the Milwaukee, Chicago, and Los Angeles areas, and then it's evolved over time, it has apparently worked out, and therefore the two companies really wanted coming together of this concept. And at the time when they first rolled this out, Kohl's stock popped again just on the rumors about how big this was going to be and the possible future integration of Amazon products. And we see that actually bearing fruit over this last holiday season with a lot of different Amazon products being featured at Kohl's stores. The one downside, in my opinion, in my very humble and naive opinion, was that many of those products were in the back of Kohl's store, behind the toys, behind the home furnishings, pretty much in the very back of the store where the restrooms are. And that was maybe something that could be improved upon. So this was a pilot program as well. And it was recently announced that they would plan on expanding it to 200 stores in the near future. Beginning in July, though, the return program will be rolled out to all Kohl's locations in 48 states. From the outside looking in, very reasonable to think here that around 2 years ago was enough for Amazon and Kohl's to work out the kinks in the pilot program before a nationwide rollout. And the press release brought about something we don't hear a lot about in relation to Amazon: omnichannel. Most of the talk, it was in reference to the existing omnichannel capabilities of Kohl's, but still, it is unusual to hear omnichannel reference to Amazon, who has basically no brick and mortar footprint in comparison to its robust online presence.
Now we move on to headlines coming out of CVS's latest earnings call, and those had much to do with their decision to close 46 stores. This earnings call was this week, and it's interesting because CVS has nearly 10,000 stores nationwide, so 46 stores, that's a comparative drop in the bucket, especially considering they've opened more than 100 locations in the past year, so they're still running a net positive as far as store growth is concerned. But one of the reasons news outlets kind of freaked out is because we've seen a lot of growth from both CVS and Walgreens in this space. To be honest, only a matter of time before some of these underperforming stores in their networks closed, especially those either without a footprint that allow for in-store clinics or some with an ungainly footprint. There's actually a store in Springfield, Missouri that's closing over 60,000 square feet of CVS that's closing down there. I think a lot of argument could be made that it's not a need for a CVS that large. And let's face it, there's a lot of cannibalization in this space with multiple occurrences of a CVS right next to a Walgreens or a Rite Aid, or just a mile or so maybe from another CVS in a non-compact urban area. Now, CVS was fairly transparent as to the cost of these closures, claiming that they would cost around $135 million during their first quarter earnings report. So these were already kind of on the balance sheet, which is to say that some of the closures actually have already happened. And that's why it was a little bit funny for us to see the likes of USA Today and others run some gloomy headlines about this realization. But it's interesting because you look into these stories and they're talking about, yeah, pretty much everyone has that same caveat. Like, brick and mortar retailers have struggled because of online shopping, this, that, and the other thing. But these stories ignored a major part of the analyst Q&A on the call, where CEO Larry Merlo said that they're looking actually at building out their store presence in certain markets to fulfill their hub and spoke strategy. He spoke specifically of Houston, saying that they need really about 15 to 20 more stores there to build out their full-on strategy. That means they do plan for further brick and mortar growth in the immediate future. But overall, on this earnings call, you know, we wanted to touch on the store closures because that's what garnered the headlines. But of greater importance to us was front of store sales during this earnings call. Since we've discussed the retail pharmacy industry at length recently, we won't bore anyone with the pharmacy part of the details, but here's the key takeaway. Late in front of store sales actually increased again for CVS in this first quarter.
They certainly did. And this was something that really took us by surprise because we sound like broken records anytime we talk about a CVS earnings call. And that the front of store sales are failing and the percentage of overall revenue that they bring in is increasing in perpetuity for, guess what, pharmacy sales, the segment that is ever growing for these particular retailers. And if you look, Trent, at some of the bigger numbers here, the greater importance to us was those front of store sales. And the front of store sales actually increased. They noted the increase was driven by increase in health product sales. This is something that CVS has been wanting to push for some time, ever since they branded to CVS Health. So this is an overarching initiative for the company. And the overall increase was greater than the percentage of stores added since the prior year's first quarter. The revenue increase overall of 1.5% in front store sales is on top of an increase in 2017 to 2018 of 2.3%. This against a backdrop where just about every other pharmacy retailer, including Walgreens, by the way, seems to be struggling with front of store sales. Rite Aid, by the way, a retailer that I am close to, seems to just be struggling time after time with foot traffic. So not only are people probably buying less front of store sale items there, they're probably buying less pharmacy goods as well. Same store sales for CVS were up 3.8% overall, with 4.9% coming from pharmacy, 0.4% coming from front of store. Front of store was up around 1.6% in terms of comp sales back in 2018. And if you look on a two-year stack, Trent, 2% of the front store comps looks incredible. That 2% increase there compared to the negative numbers from other industry players, some of which I just mentioned. Not only that, the company also mentioned that the Easter shift into the second quarter negatively impacted front store sales by about 80 basis points in the first quarter, meaning that they may indeed be a positive impact in the second quarter of this year to front store comps. You see that transition really playing a key role there, or perhaps playing a key role. However, as a percentage of retail sales, front store sales continued to decrease. However, this was driven by those surging pharmacy sales we noted a few moments ago. Part of the positivity in this front of store, they feel, is coming from the refreshes in select markets. These refreshes are pushing self-care products and wellness products as they add in the MinuteClinics to certain markets. This comes along with the expansion of a number of wellness SKUs in these locations. Additionally, they've added what they call a care concierge in certain markets, basically an employee tasked with connecting the pharmacy, clinic, and front store by servicing the customers in all three areas, sort of a heightened customer experience, if you will. The company also said during the analyst Q&A that health and beauty as a whole was seeing an improvement in sales and was helping to drive front store margins.
We wrap up the lightning round with Target as they release yet another private label product line, and this is another eco-friendly version. The announcement was one of several Target made about energy efficiency and eco-awareness during Earth Week, so a lot of PR push from Target. Our main question, though, has to do with whether or not Target truly needed yet another private label brand, or if the strength of their other private label brands will perhaps carry over to this one. The new brand is called Everspring. It was rolled out just in time for Earth Week, or as Target says, spring cleaning. The product line consists of around 70 products geared towards cleaning or fragrances, so the line does include essential oils and candles, but is mostly made up of soaps and detergents, very similar to a brand like Method, actually. And the reason we question this move somewhat is because Target has been known for a very long time for similar in-house product lines. In addition, they've pushed products from brands like Method, and they were, in fact, one of the first retailers to carry Method products wholesale in those stores. Now, you wonder if long-term, rolling out their own private label product that would compete with Method, this might erode the relationship that they have with Method or similar brands, or if that'll matter at all. One thing I do know, though, the design look of the Everspring products are, in my opinion, kind of uninspiring. Dark green labels with a serif font. This font is very rounded. It's not as sleek as what you see from a lot in this particular space. So it doesn't really stand out necessarily like a lot of other Target private label products do.
And unlike a brand like Method, the packaging itself seems uninspiring. Brands in this space have worked to find unique packaging to make the product stand out on store shelves, and this is not that. They've promised to roll out additional products in this line as the year progresses, and as with the other private label brands, Archer Farms comes to mind, they've placed a focus on seasonal items and scents with Everspring. In the end, adding yet another private label brand may not matter all that much to Target or their bottom line. Obviously, this is a bigger initiative than just an Earth Day PR ploy. Similar private label brands have worked well with the likes of Kroger, but we wonder if the marketplace may be a little bit too crowded at Target for this to truly stand out. And this is interesting, Trent. This comes as I've actually met somebody who works in PR at a company that makes private label goods for both Target, CVS, and a couple other grocers. And it's interesting because if you look at those brands, you would think that they are directly tied into Target. Like Target is making those products, but that is simply not the case. Oftentimes, different marketing agencies that work for the retailers will end up reaching out to these companies, forming a partnership, and then those products therefore get sold from the manufacturer of the goods. In this case, it was candy bars, to those larger retailers and trying to brand their own extension out for those products.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, a segment where we look ahead at a story we're keeping an eye on for the next week, month, or year. And for this segment, we start out with Layton.
My story has to do with the nation's largest retailer. Yes, you guessed it, Walmart. Walmart's in our radar again. And for this, I'm looking at a report that says that Walmart is going to be testing out a new structure for employees, mostly a structure for management and supervisors at different locations throughout the country. They're going to be piloting this program at 75 locations, primarily their neighborhood market extension. If you look here, according to Bloomberg, they're going to have managers set up to where the program is going to have or enlist normal store managers, but underneath those, they're going to have what's called business leads, basically assistant managers going to be taking over a wider role. If you think of this in terms of maybe a previous hierarchy, it would be club managers at Sam's Club, followed by co-managers, followed by assistant managers. And at Walmart, usually the same sort of thing, where they have a co-manager who's second in line there in the hierarchy, and then assistant managers, and then supervisors. However, these assistant managers, or business leads as we'll call them, are going to make a little bit more money than they had historically, around 10% more. And they also are going to be taking on more responsibilities that may have been historically handed off to store managers. So this is going to give them an incentive to do a little bit more, to stand out in the company, and most likely, logically, make their way up to, inevitably, the store manager position over time. Also, what's interesting here is there's going to be a significant bump up in pay for team leads or supervisors in those stores who are going to be working under those new business lead positions. They're going to start out around $18 an hour and will supervise around 8 to 10 frontline employees. Those employees, of course, are going to be subject to Walmart's policy of having around a $10 minimum wage. Of course, this all comes as the company has been trying different things with human resources and trying really to retain the people that they've been hiring to make people more pleased about coming to the workplace. And I think on paper, everything that they've done over the last couple of years has really done well in terms of making sure that the stores are streamlined and that there's not really a high turnover rate. Because we all know high turnover equals high cost, and that eats your bottom line. And I think over time, Walmart really does need to change their perception with the public. And if you look at them in terms of how they're perceived, how they take care of their employees, they're still far behind the likes of Costco and a few other retailers that really try to emphasize taking care of your employees with not only the salaries and hourly wages, but also the benefits as well.
So my looking ahead story actually goes overseas, and we don't talk much about international retail on the show simply because you know, we're familiar with U.S. and Canadian retailer. So we'll let those experts talk about U.K. and Australian retail and Asian retail. But in this case, I'm looking at Australia because IKEA is opening its smallest store in the world this week in Australia. They have plans to open perhaps around 12 of these stores across the country by the end of the year. By country, again, I still mean Australia, and about 20 of these stores altogether. Now, when I talk about small square footprint, I mean it. At around 100 square meters or right around 1,000 square feet, just above 1,000 square feet, in fact. So that is just a fraction of the regular IKEA footprint there. If you're at all familiar with the IKEAs in the United States, they are enormous behemoths of a store. These stores are a little bit different. These are more home planning studios that they're trying out in Australia. And part of the reason is because they've noticed consumer habits to be a little bit different in Australia. So they're rolling out some of these studios. Interestingly enough, the studio concept has become more popularized, whether it's a store-in-store concept like what the Container Store has, or we're seeing other retailers go more towards this studio concept. IKEA opening this location in Australia kind of makes you wonder if they might try that out in the U.S. at some point in time. You know, of course, when they open a location in the U.S., it's a big to-do. Of course, large square footprints mean a lot of work has to go into it. But also shoppers here, you know, it's interesting because a lot of them like IKEA. They like the idea of spending the entire day at an IKEA, but some of them don't really think about an IKEA when it comes to quick trips to the store because they basically harness you in there for so long. So it'll be interesting to see how IKEA melds this concept for other countries and other markets and whether that will happen beyond Australia in the future. And that's why it's my looking ahead story to see how IKEA leverages this store format in Australia towards other countries or if they do so. So that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent. We'll be back next week, providing one of us doesn't get ill, and we'll have more retail news and notes.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.